Game On 2FM with Green Firm. Healthy snacking made easy with Green Firm's high protein on the go range. Available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.
Thanks to the superstar Ginny Green, back with you tomorrow at 3. It's Tuesday, the 5th of January.
And coming up on Game On tonight, we get the South African perspective on the expansion of the Pro 14 from Wim Visser.
Youngs down towards LaRue. Good tackle from Wilson. McTempy. McTempy putting him behind for Look out, back to Makazoli. McTempy. Oh my.
Mark Langdon will be joining us to discuss Southampton's magnificent performance last night from European football and, of course, the Portuguese piglets.
What is this? What is this? For what? Why?
And with a return for training delayed, we asked John Casey and Damien Lawler, is there a changing of the guard in Mayo?
We have played 4 minutes of stoppage time. It's all over. Mayo have beaten Dublin in the All-Ireland football semi-final.
You can text us. Our number is 51552. You can tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Yeah, I say I really enjoyed Southampton last night. Danny Ings is just a gifted individual, isn't he?
Like, seriously, how can one team be denied so many penalties? Somebody was saying today or sometime around now, do you remember Rafa Benitez's infamous facts press conference where he took out the slip of paper and started reading all these facts about Manchester United? And it was the moment that the Liverpool squad said, the league is finished, we're gone now. That you'd wonder, could last night have been Klopp's equivalent?
Oh, I still think Pep is going to have his say, unfortunately. I think Man City are still the team. As much as I wanted to be United, I still think Pep will have his say.
I was going to say, as a United fan, would you rather see Man City win the league than Liverpool win the league?
Great question.
No, I'd rather see Liverpool. I'm probably one of those strange Man United fans that would be actually on the Liverpool side of it rather than the City side, but I would be more for Liverpool winning in Man City.
It does show, though, that Klopp does see United as a threat. You know what I mean? Straight away, you know, they're into second place to win their game in hand. Now they can go top, and he's mentioning them straight afterwards about the penalties. You know, I just think he is.
Yeah, but that's probably not bad psychology. Can United then go and handle the pressure? That's all about reverse psychology, Dunica. You were surely involved in that plenty of times in your life.
Yeah, well, we've seen it with Arsenal, whether going wrong for Sam Allardyce, him saying Arsenal are in a relegation battle and then they go and bop them. So I say, oh, wow. So you can get it wrong.
Exactly.
We've an awful lot to get through between now and 7 o'clock. We've talked an awful lot ourselves about the reaction in Ireland and the reaction amongst the Pro 14 to the expansion to the Pro 16. So in a couple of minutes time, we're going to get a South African perspective on that. We mentioned we've European football, much more to come. Big story emerging from the English FA today. So Kieran Trippier obviously completed his transfer from Spurs to Atletico Madrid. The English FA then banned him for 10 weeks and fined him $70,000. They had judged him to have breached betting guidelines. So the reasoned decision, or it's a 46-page written summary of the case, has been published. I presume you've both read every single line of the 40. It's thorough, to say the least.
Synopsis.
Well, basically, the synopsis is that in one of the WhatsApps to his mates, he used the phrase "lump on." He told a friend to lump on him transferring from Spurs to Atletico. Now, when you get stuck into the figures, one of his friends put on two bets of £22 each at 6-4, and another friend put on, I think it was like £150 all in. So like the facts and the figures and the sums are very small, I would think, in the grand scheme of things.
The second pal had £300 at 11-4 on, did he?
The stuff today, I don't think it was quite that high, but like, we're not looking at thousands is the main thing. Or maybe I'm looking at this, I'm reading all of this and I'm thinking this guy was probably slightly stupid to trust certain people or some of the phraseology he used rather than it being some massively planned deception.
It was, but maybe because I come from a horse racing background and you realise how responsible you have to be around what information or what you say and what way it can be perceived. But at the end of it all, Damien, a bet is to risk a sum of money on the unknown result of an event in the hope of winning more than you have risked. But those two lads knew the result therefore they weren't having a bet. So theoretically, I think they should be chased for fraud.
One thing I'd wonder in that then, should that not be allowed to place a bet on? Is there an onus on the bookmakers?
Well, is this not the bigger argument that exists about the relationship that is ongoing between sport and the gambling industry, where you can now place a bet on anything you want, and that's as big an issue as a fella using a little bit of loose language in text message exchanges?
Yeah, but I think that's where your responsibility and your... If Kieran Trippier knew he was going to Atletico Madrid, he knew their result and he informed his friends and they got a few quid out of it. Some might say, yeah, well done, but that is insider trading in the stock market. There's gambling on presidential elections, on just betting on most things the world over. So you said responsibility lies on the bookmaker not to form a market on certain things. Well, if Kieran Trippier doesn't tell his friends, there's no issue here.
And I can understand that when it comes to sport, you know what I mean? If he's telling them the team or if he's telling them tactics, but it's stuff like this, I think this is a life choice. You know, they're like, Kieran, are you coming on holidays with us? No, I'm off. You know, I won't be able to make that. And I don't think
it's quite as simple as that, no dinners. It wasn't, are you coming on holidays? The questions were, are you going to Atletico Madrid? The answer was, yes, I am. Answer was lump on. Now I think you're making it a tad blasé there to say, are you coming on holidays? It just generally gets dropped into conversation. I don't think it quite happened that way.
It's part of the problem in this then as well, is that if you apply this black and white to every conversation that exists between every professional sports or every professional footballer and someone who places a bid, like a bet, they're going to be having cases like this every day of the week.
Yeah, but as I said in the beginning, Damien, I was probably aware of it because I was a jockey, well, horse racing, and what training, gambling.
What training would you have had?
No training, only that you had to be responsible. I'd be aware of your responsibility. So anything that I knew or was willing to share with anybody had to be shared in the public domain. And once it's public knowledge, therefore it's up to the bookmaker to lay the bet and the people to take or use the knowledge in whatever way they want. Now, most of it's only opinion. I think X horse will win X race, and of course X horse doesn't win X race. So most of it was only ever opinion. But on things that might change a market, as in which horse I was going to ride in a race that would have an effect on the market, I had to make that knowledge publicly known and not just known to confidants. Mm. And that is the responsibility that's on any... But I say, coming from a horse racing background, in soccer, I don't know what way it works, or in rugby, but Donegal, if you're part of the Munster squad and you know that none of the first team are playing next week and it's the B team out, and you tell your pals and they can get on the opposition who are coming to Thomond Park to face a half a Munster team, that's insider trading.
Yeah, and look, Damien, from our end, it is something that changed later in my career. I know in Worcester there was mandatory education on, there were six things you had to do. There was modules in alcohol, social media, consent, gambling, and there was two, drugs was broken into performance enhancing and prescription drugs. And you had to attend the RPAs and the club's educational courses. You had to sign in, you had to make sure that you were aware. And then during the year, you had to do an online course, which is actually quite difficult and hard to get through, but the days of kind of saying I didn't know are gone for athletes. But I do question some of the bets that are allowed to be put on in certain, you know, I think some of these ones where, you know, players moving, I think that is just so ripe and open for this type of a situation that maybe it shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah, but then you could expand that on with first yellow cards, first throw-ins. You know, we're not going to solve this issue between now and 7
o'clock. I'd say not.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to move on.
Go back to last night, Damien. Just the end of a conversation we had with Donal Lenehan, and you made a very good point that neither of our Lions contingent agreed with. So if you'd like to go back to last night, Damien, I'm giving you the floor.
I theorised that perhaps the Lions tour, rather than the Lions go to South Africa, that the South Africans could come to the, can I use the phrase, home nations?
And were you laughed at? I think you could play.
Well, I was slightly ridiculed, I felt. Oh, sorry, no, I think there was disgust eminent from my good friend, Mr. O'Callaghan, and Donal Lenehan was possibly slightly taken aback. And then I read on the BBC website today and also on other outlets across the UK that the prospect of the Lions coming to Ireland, Scotland, England and Wales is being strongly considered.
You were in the know. You knew.
You knew. What did you know, Damien?
My insider trading. Yeah, so when I pay for my when I pay my mortgage off in July as a result of having put a bet on the South Africa playing in the Aviva for the third test, yeah.
Oh,
you're disgusted still, Donegal.
I am. Look, for me, the Lions is the pinnacle of rugby, and I know revenue and money is so important, and I know, Ruby, you feel, and you're right, you know, there's an onus to entertain and go out and perform, but put Ireland and Scotland together and play Wales and England, put France and Italy, make another Autumn Nations Cup, do something else to generate money, but don't mess with the Lions.
Are you afraid it's going to damage your brand as a former Lion?
Do you have your Lions headphones on, Donegal?
I am. I do have right headphones. They're not Lions ones. No, I just think I think it's pinnacle. I think it's beautiful. It's pure. I'll give you an example. We played Manawatui, and Bill Beaumont was our team manager, and he went up and made a speech after the game about how they toured there when he was a player, and the stuff that went on that involved one player being escorted out and another one leaving through a window, which was a good crack and good fun at the time. And then their president got up and spoke about how he remembered it from their side, and there's something that just bonds old school rugby about that, and I think it's the only thing that hasn't been properly commercialised, and I think it's
would you stop?
So no, you're talking purely about the players here and the feeling of being a Lions player.
Would you stop? Look at the... Sorry, we're going to have to move on in a second. But, like, Jesus, log on to any sports apparel website and you'll see the extent to which it's been commercialised.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. In terms of jerseys, and I know there's been games, and I played in them, the games against Argentina, the games against... And you understand it has to do that to survive. But I just worry that it will... I think it would devalue... Okay.
It's a one-off.
We need to move on. As it happens, we are going to South Africa, to Johannesburg, I think, and South African native and former Italian international Wim Visser is with us. Wim, how are you?
Very well, thanks, man. All the best.
It's good to talk to you. Well, it's I'm not sure. Did you catch the tail end of that conversation about the Lions? It's been floated today about the prospect of the Lions coming to Europe rather than, South Africa coming to Europe rather than the Lions going to South Africa. Is that a deal or a scenario that would generate any sense of interest or acceptance amongst South African rugby?
I don't think so. It's all about the British and Irish Lions coming to South Africa. It's such an historic tour. You know, every 4 years they're touring South Africa, then they're going to Australia, then they're going to New Zealand. It's all about that tour. It's just going to put a damper on it if we had to come across and play that tour in Europe. It's not going to be the same thing.
How likely, before we chat about the Pro 14 expansion, if you were to look at the landscape in South Africa at the moment, is it feasible at all in your mind that that tour can go ahead in the format with which we would be used?
Look, it's very difficult times around the world with this pandemic going on in South Africa. Obviously, we've gone back down to lockdown 3 due to the fact that our COVID cases have increased substantially. It would be, and I believe, an absolute disaster if the tour had to happen and you're not allowed to have your tourists coming into the country to support the British and Irish Lions, because that's what it's all about. It's difficult times, and hopefully we can get around it, because it is such a big money-generating tour for our country, for the tourists coming in. And there's so much heritage and tradition around the British and Irish Lions coming to our country. We're waiting for the guys. We want to see it. Let's hope and pray that it happens.
Yeah, Vim, just on that, I was lucky enough to tour in 2009 to South Africa, but away from rugby, economically, how efficient for the whole country is a big tour like that? Because I've seen the crowds of Irish, English, Welsh, Scottish that, you know, travel around and make it their holidays and make it once in a 4-year trip.
Exactly. With all the tourists coming in from Britain, you know, they're coming in with influx of foreign currency. And as you say, they come along, they do the tour for 4 weeks and make it their holiday, because, like we know, South Africa is a beautiful country. There's a lot of wildlife, there's a lot of coastal areas. And for someone coming across from Europe to support the British and Irish Lions. It's a memory that will last forever.
And Vim, looking ahead to the what we're known now as the Rainbow Cup, there's good excitement within the Irish provinces, purely for the challenge that the likes of the Sharks, the Lions, the Bulls and the Stormers will bring. We watch them in Super Rugby, we see them in Currie Cup. But what's the reaction in South Africa to these franchises now taking part in what we would call a kind of Celtic competition?
Well, it's a massive positive reaction. Look, firstly, it's the ideal preparation for South African players ahead of the British and Irish Lions Tour to South Africa. Our Super Rugby franchises will be back in international competition, major setups, since compared to our domestic competition. So there's so much excitement and positivity around the fact that we've been introduced into the Rainbow Cup. It's absolutely amazing.
And just on it, we've seen Ulster's Marcel Kutsia, he's heading back home. There is an awful lot of South African players playing within the Pro 14. Do you see them keeping within their clubs, or do you see Razzy looking to start bringing his foreign players back into the system?
I do see a lot of players coming back into our system, but at the end of the day, it's all about contracts, etc. As a rugby player, you're only one injury away from ending your career. So obviously, playing in Europe, there is the attraction of earning euro, which is a hell of a lot stronger than our rand, earning pounds, etc. So I still believe there'll be a massive influx of South African players into Europe, as it's always been. But for us to come across there and be involved in different conditions, you know, it's cold, it's wind, it's rain, it's a lot more direct and physical up front. The forward battles are a hell of a lot more stronger. There's a lot more emphasis on the scrum. You know, past in Super Rugby, the scrum was just another phase to set up and evolve play from there. Whereas in Europe, there's so much emphasis on your scrum to dominate your opposition, dominate them physically. So there's a major excitement about the fact that we have been introduced.
Part of the conversation that has existed up here is the fact that particularly the Irish provinces who are dominating the Pro 14 are in need of a higher level of competition in order to help them at the latter stages of the Heineken Cup. From your perspective, are South African teams going to benefit in terms of competitiveness by playing in the Pro 14 compared to the exposure to, you know, the All Blacks Australia, other nations they would play against in Super Rugby?
I believe most definitely so. Look, European rugby has improved drastically over the past few years. You know, everyone thought that when the Cheetahs and the Kings, let's call them Tier 2 Super Rugby sides, would evolve and dominate the Pro 14. But we were woken up to a rude surprise, because at the end of the day, Pro 14 is a very, very good competition, extremely competitive. And then we need to realise, Franskin sides like to play that ruck and run style of rugby, expansive. Whereas when you play in Europe, the conditions are totally different. It's tight, it's windy, it's raining, it's cold. It's a total adaptation of the game compared to what we used to in South Africa.
And I would presume part of the long-term ambition then for South African rugby would be for their teams to initially play within the Celtic League or the expanded Celtic League, and then presumably push on to the big money or the larger exposure of the Heineken Cup?
Well, most definitely so. It would be a lovely format if there could be a South African side or two introduced into the Heineken Cup, the exposure of Heineken Cup, the money of Heineken Cup. It would be massive for rugby in general. You must also realise that South African sides, when they're travelling to Australia and New Zealand, it's like a 24, 26-hour flight. The turnaround time and the recovery when you've arrived in Australia and New Zealand is massive, whereas from South Africa into Europe, it's an overnight flight. Your turnaround and your recovery to get into your system for your preparation for your next match is a hell of a lot quicker. So compared to the Super Rugby franchises, I think it's going to benefit the South African sides, and I definitely believe it will benefit the eventual Rainbow Cup due to the fact that, you know, the stronger level that you're playing in, you're only going to get better.
V, Finn, does it stop there, though? Club side to side, and you were chatting about Super Rugby playing in the Champions Cup, but we're all looking at the global calendar. Could we start to see South Africa integrating more, like maybe down the track, in terms of a Six Nations or the Autumn Nations Cup, as it was called this year?
Yeah, well, can you imagine if that had happened? It would be amazing for rugby in general. A South African side playing maybe in the Six Nations, I believe it would be an experience. It would be thrilling for rugby in general around the world.
Absolutely. Vim, thanks so much for joining us. Hopefully the Lions Tour does go ahead in its current format, but we're unsure of that. But one thing we are sure, we can look forward to some incredible rugby in the Rainbow Cup. Thanks so much for joining us on Game On.
Definitely, sir. Compliments of the season to all listeners, and thank you for your time.
Thanks.
That's Vim Visser joining us there from South Africa. Former, I think you just about missed each other, Dunica, in terms of he played Ireland on a couple of occasions, late 90s, early noughties, so you wouldn't have...
He sounds tough. I wouldn't like to cross him at all.
There you go.
You're not overly certain about his flight times, though. He's a little bit out there. 24 hours from South Africa to Sydney. Depends. Not from Dublin to Johannesburg.
They're not all getting your flights.
I just want to think he might check that one out now himself.
Well, there's an ad break to take, which is 2.5 minutes long. So coming up in 4 minutes' time, Ruby Walsh gives us flight times from Johannesburg to all
It's 11:45 to Sydney, from Johannesburg to Sydney.
Oh, you're a nerd, Ruby.
See? I just googled it, Dunica.
See? He's got very, very fast broadband in Kildare. Right, we have a quick break to take. We're going to chat European football with Mark Langdon on the far side of this. Stay with us.
With Green Firm. Green Firm's new on-the-go chicken bites are natural, high in protein, and packed with flavour.
Game On. European football.
Welcome back to Game On. Mark Langdon joins us on the line. And Mark, where better to start than at St Mary's last night? And where have the unbeatable goal-scoring machine that were Liverpool this time last year exactly gone?
He's loving it. He's loving
it. A good, but where else could you start? Where's that goal machine gone? I think that they are lacking a bit of sharpness in that final third, for sure. You know, Firmino, Mane, Salah all had moments last night and the ball would just bounce off them, or the shot wasn't quite right, and it wasn't to the levels that we've come to expect of Liverpool. I think you could say the same for most teams around Europe this season, that they're maybe not quite as sharp as what you would anticipate them to be, and ordinarily they would be. I didn't think there was too much wrong with the performance against Newcastle. There was just a moment lacking. Against Southampton, that first half performance particularly just wasn't right. And Jurgen Klopp absolutely spot on to call the players out, because it wasn't good enough. And for all the issues about, you know, that they haven't got enough defenders and Henderson's alongside Fabinho, it wasn't really that was the problem. It was their attacking play. Alexander-Arnold, so often a thrilling outlet down the right-hand side, was very wasteful and sloppy defensively as well. I've already mentioned the front three weren't quite at it. So there are definitely some concerns, I think, for Liverpool away from home, because this run has just gone on now for too long, that they're dropping a lot of points away from home.
Poor old Alexander-Arnold just had an absolute nightmare, didn't he?
He did. I've noticed in recent weeks that teams have definitely attacked him and seen him as the weak point defensively. If you go back to that game against Spurs, Bergwijn played on the left-hand side of the Tottenham attack, missed two glorious opportunities. West Brom had a big counter-attack, which they failed to take. I think it was Carlon Grant, and that came attacking Alexander-Arnold. So defensively, I think Liverpool have always known that he was a bit of a weak spot, but what you got from him going forward compensated for that. But as you say, Ruby, last night he was really poor attacking, and you know, and then you start to highlight defensively his problems. And Gareth Southgate, the England national team boss, has never really sort of kind of bought into the Alexander-Arnold hype. He doesn't pick him all the time and has tried out many different options down the right-hand side. I personally think that it was just a bad game from him, and he would definitely be my choice to be the England right back, if the European Championship was starting tomorrow. But it was definitely a really bad performance from him, and I suppose if you give the ball away 30-odd times in one game, then it's going to be difficult for any team to win the match.
But Mark, you're a sensible man at the back of it all. I know you'll agree with Jurgen Klopp's assessment that it's all a conspiracy to give Manchester United more penalties, and fair play to him. All the problems that are in the game at the moment, VAR and everything else, he has finally called out the biggest scandal of all. Very odd timing.
I think that Manchester United's penalties is definitely worthy of discussion. I like the way that Jurgen Klopp said that it wasn't the reason why they lost the game, but he thought he'd bring it up anyway, that they didn't get that penalty. I don't like to see... I didn't think it was a penalty on Mane. I can see why some people felt that it might be, and given some of the penalties that we've had previously, you could definitely make a point that it was. I don't think because others have been given that you have to keep on giving these penalties. I think Manchester United have been very lucky with some of the ones that they've got. I think Pogba and Fernandes have kind of got it working perfectly, how they can initiate contact and sort of make the referee sort of give penalties almost, and that they do have this sort of expert sort of way of winning them. But I still don't think that the Mane one was. I didn't think the Pogba one was against Aston Villa, and I think that the Premier League has got itself into a situation here where there are just too many penalties being given, that there are too many soft fouls that are giving players an 80% chance of scoring, and it's not great really when there are so many being given. So if we can cut them out, I'm all for it.
I'm just grateful as a United fan that we have Bruno Fernandes to convert them all. But moving onwards and across the channel, I suppose, to France, to Paris Saint-Germain, and Mario Pochettino is back.
He is, yeah. Pochettino gave his first press conference ahead of their midweek game. He is a fan's favourite at Paris. He was the former captain, so it made sense. I mean, it's a great appointment, I think, from Paris Saint-Germain's point of view, because Thomas Tuchel had lost the dressing room to some extent, but he'd also lost the faith of those above him. He's not the best when it comes to managing above, and he'd had fallings out with Leonardo, the sporting director, and it's never great when that then plays out in the press, and he was picking players almost in a way of annoying the sporting director. He was playing people out of position to prove a point that they didn't bring enough players in the summer. I think Pochettino will unite those kind of issues in the squad and in the boardroom. He's got the connection with the supporters. I think it will mean he'll win trophies, and so people that say that he failed at Tottenham because he didn't win trophies won't be able to throw that against him. It's just a really difficult job for Paris in terms of working out whether he's done well or not, because ultimately many will judge him on whether he wins the Champions League or not, and it's really difficult competition to win. Even the best managers don't win it too often, so there will be that pressure to win the Champions League, at least from the outside. He has said the most important thing is that Paris Saint-Germain win and play with style, and that's another issue that all of these super clubs have got now, where winning just isn't enough for a lot of them. They do want it to be with a certain playing style, and Pochettino, what we saw at Tottenham, what we saw at Southampton, is he will bring that style with him, and I'm looking forward to seeing if he can get Neymar to press like he did sort of Adam Lallana or players at Tottenham that he had. So that's definitely something I think to look out for in the early days.
Mark, whatever about getting him to press and keeping him to strict to COVID regulations is a job in itself, but it's part of his problem, isn't he? Like a massive dressing room of, you wouldn't call them egos, but big players, and like you mentioned, the board, he is going to have his work cut out.
Oh, he will. I mean, Paris Saint-Germain, completely different to the jobs he's had previously. Espanyol, a small team in Barcelona. I mean, you barely sort of call them the second team in Barcelona. They that sort of joke about the Liverpool, the biggest team in Liverpool, and then it's Liverpool reserves or whatever. I mean, it's not like that. Barcelona's the biggest team in Barcelona, and then probably the reserves are the second biggest team, and Espanyol sort of find themselves in third. You know, Southampton doesn't bring with it pressure. Even Tottenham, not somewhere you're expected to win, and he didn't have those egos to deal with. It was mainly sort of young players that wanted to learn, whereas now it will be a completely different challenge for him. I think that this is an important step for him to take, though, because definitely that there have been other jobs that have come up, like Juventus, and maybe people have wondered whether he's got that ability to manage a Messi, a Ronaldo, an Mbappe, a Neymar or whatever. So this is his opportunity to prove that. And for all that he'll say that he'll treat everybody the same, he won't be able to, because there are certain players that just demand sort of more, I suppose. And Mbappe used to get the ump if he got substituted in the 80th minute, even if he'd scored three goals and the manager was trying to rest him, and he'd make it about himself. So he has got to prove he can manage those egos. I mean, Neymar has been throwing sort of New Year's parties in Brazil and Christmas parties, and that just brings with it the kind of that kind of egotistical sort of approach that he's not used to. So it will be interesting to see how he manages it. I'd back him to succeed, I think. But
Mark, the other thing as well is looking at it in a very simplistic way in terms of cash and the resources that are at his disposal. It's a significantly different challenge that he faces now, that there's great opportunity with the wealth that exists behind Paris Saint-Germain, but that brings with it a different pressure than he would have experienced, say, at Espanyol, Spurs, Southampton, where Spurs had the means but chose not to spend it. The checkbook brings an added weight of expectation.
It does. I mean, and there are some people that sort of report on Tottenham on a weekly basis that say that there was money to spend and that Pochettino didn't want to spend it all the time and was, happy sort of looking to within the youth team and to try not to block up those pathways. If you think to somebody like Kyle Walker-Peters, who played against Mane last night for Southampton, Pochettino was kind of adamant, really, that he didn't want another right back because he wanted to create that space for eventually Kyle Walker-Peters. And there were some people at Tottenham just didn't think he was good enough. I mean, maybe Pochettino was right, but he will be, I think, expected to spend money and to kind of work with the big superstars. But also, there is a side of Paris Saint-Germain that they've let a lot of their best young players go over the last couple of years because there has been this attitude of, we've got to bring in the biggest names and the best players. And that hasn't brought them sort of the success in terms of what they wanted to be. So maybe there will be a different attitude from within Paris that, yes, we want Mbappe and we want Neymar, but maybe it's time to kind of bring through some of our own as well, because Paris has been absolutely, in terms of the academy, it's churned out so many good players, many of them that have then since gone on to kind of play in the Bundesliga and stuff like that. So maybe this is a change of attitude from Paris Saint-Germain, but ultimately, whatever we say about bringing through youth players or dealing with Neymar, it will come down to, for a lot of people, can he beat Barcelona in the Champions League? Will they win the Champions League? It's rarely as simple as that, but for a lot of people it will be. If he wins the Champions League, he'll be seen as a success, and if he doesn't, he won't. I mean, I tend not to be that black and white about things, but I'm sure a lot of people will be.
Mark, moving from one fashion-conscious city to another and to Italy, Milan. Is there a case to be made that AC Milan are the most improved team in Serie A?
Oh yeah, I'd say that it's absolutely nailed on that they are. This is a team that is absolutely flying at the moment. When Ibrahimovic came back, he was the reason that they kind of picked their form up. He was inspirational. He got injured, and then many people felt like that would be the kind of title race would die down a bit while he was out injured. They've had absolutely none of that. They keep on scoring goals. They keep on winning. A 2-0 win away to Benevento at the weekend, I think, is would be what you would expect of a team that's top of the table in Italy. But they had their central midfielder, Tonali, sent off in the first half. So that game became a lot more difficult. Some of the younger players, Rafael Leao, scored an amazing individual goal from sort of out wide as he chipped the goalkeeper. So other players are stepping up. They've got the ultimate test, I suppose, coming tomorrow night, where they play Juventus, the perennial Italian champions that are struggling by their own standards this season. It's a massive game, really, because if Milan win, then you've got to give them a big chance of going all the way. If they don't, not only does it sort of bring Juventus closer to them, it gives the opportunity for their City rivals, Inter, to maybe go top of the league as well. And they scored 6 goals at the weekend. So it's not just in the Premier League where we've got this kind of really congested table at the moment. It's happening in a lot of European countries. Maybe that is to do with the no pre-season and no fans in stadiums. I'm not quite sure. But it's a massive game tomorrow night. Well, I know there's a Manchester derby on Wednesday in terms of the League Cup, but in Italy, they've got their own kind of, you know, real heavyweight clash, sort of a must-not-miss fixture.
Juve are obviously relying heavy on Ronaldo for goals. He scored 14 in his last 11 league games. But what happened to Romelu Lukaku when he was at Manchester United? Since he's gone to Inter Milan, he scored 50 goals, had 9 assists in his first 70 games.
Playing with a proper team.
Oh, and it was a brilliant goal he scored. It was an absolutely brilliant goal he scored at the weekend. Back to goal, just completely rolled the defender before showing the composure that maybe some had questioned. That kind of, you know, just that finishing touch when he was in England, even when he was scoring goals, there were definitely questions to be had as to whether he had the touch to be considered an elite footballer. He's improved, I would say, in those kind of situations, you know, back to goal, being able to link up with teammates. That's where I think we've seen a different Lukaku. He said that Conte has worked with him on that and on improving his game. I also think that Manchester United, particularly under what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer wanted, it's not the style of play that Lukaku wants. You know, definitely if you look at Solskjaer's United, there's that fluidity to the attacker on many occasions, where whether it's Greenwood or Rashford or Martial or whoever plays in those forward positions, a lot of movement from them. I also wonder whether Lukaku would have improved had Bruno Fernandes been there sort of supplying that final pass, because all of United's attackers look a lot better since he arrived. So maybe the problem wasn't necessarily Lukaku, it was kind of the supply line into him from that midfield, because it was quite slow, wasn't it, before. Now that they're releasing the forwards quicker and Lukaku gets good service, and he struck up a brilliant partnership with Lautaro Martinez, who's been kind of labelled as the new Sergio Aguero. I don't think he'll stay Inter for too much longer, so might be an opportunity for maybe one of the real European big guns to sign him in the summer, maybe.
Mark, before we finish, a quick word on the Bundesliga. Bayern too clear on top, but I think a couple of years ago we all got fixated with Hoffenheim, wasn't it? Hoffenheim got promoted from nowhere and had a brilliant first season, and Union Berlin could well be the team that rob our affections this year if we follow a similar course.
Yeah, I mean, Union Berlin came up last season, and it was quite a sad story, really, because their fans had waited so long for them to play in the Bundesliga, and of course they sort of turned up for a little while and then they weren't allowed in anymore, and that they looked like a team that was maybe sort of slipping away a little bit, because they rely on that fan energy really to sort of drive them on. There's not a huge amount of quality in the team, it has to be said. However, this year that they've been one of the revelations really of the Bundesliga. Don't play quite the same sort of silky football as somebody like a Hoffenheim would have done, or even Leipzig when they came up. It's much more direct, I suppose, a kind of British style of football, but it's definitely working. I just hope that their fans can get back in the stadium soon and sort of cheer them on. I still don't see them as a European contender. I think they'll fall short of that, but definitely one of the kind of real romantic stories of the sort of Bundesliga over the last 18 months.
It's been great to watch. Mark Langdon, thanks a million. We'll be back with GAA with John Casey and Damon Oller after the break.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Healthy snacking made easy with Green Fern's high protein on the go range. Available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide. Game on.
Gaelic football.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. We are going to chat in just a couple of moments about what are planned delays to the resumption of inter-county training and the impact that may have. But I suppose retirements in Mayo are like buses this week. We've had a whole flood of them, and the latest of which is Tom Parsons, who's announced his retirement from the inter-county game. Made his debut back in 2008, went on to win three Connacht titles and an Allianz League Division 1 medal. It joins, as we mentioned, like David Clark, who went yesterday, I think, and Donald Vaughan went, was it the day before? So John Casey, himself a former Mayo footballer, is with us. Hiya, John.
Oh, thanks, Damien. Yeah, it was unbelievable what's happening down here, really. I parked the Zimmer frame in the spare room and dusted down the Copa Mundial, so I'm waiting for the call any second now. So, yeah, look at it. Well, it's been a strange time all right here, and I'm just waiting to see what else happens.
Now, can I? We sat in Croke Park, an empty Croke Park, a couple of weeks ago at the All-Ireland football final, and the whispers were going around, as tends to do before big matches, that Tom Parsons could come in to start. Or was it the final or the semi-final?
Yeah.
And here we are now, a couple of weeks later, where he's walking away from the game. They've lost an awful lot of experience over the course of the week, and one would wonder, is this fella's just deciding we've been on the road for so long, it's time to jack it in? Or does this all trace back to James Horan's assessment that he was going to build a new youthful team, not just to take on Dublin but to beat Dublin? So is there a cleaning of the deck in a way?
Well, 100%, but I suppose the fact is it's the players themselves making the decision, Damien. Like, Tom made his debut way back in 2008 in a league game against Derry, and he's represented us with great distinction, as has David Clark, of course, and Donald Vaughan. We've lost three fellas that have represented us brilliantly. But I suppose, really, when you look back on why the likes of Tom made his decision anyway, Donald Vaughan, of course, wasn't in the match day squad. He's had an injury-ravaged season. But, you know, when the game was in the melting pot, I suppose, that in Croke Park in the All-Ireland final, and it was there to be won, for want of a better word, and James Horan looks up and sees what he has available on his bench, and, you know, you see the likes of Tom there, and namely Keith Higgins, two of his fellas he would have soldiered with him for a long time, and he doesn't give them the call, you know. And when you're not called upon, when you've got that experience, when a game is in the balance, it leaves the player himself under no illusion that where you stand in the pecking order. And I kind of knew after that, when Tom wasn't brought on against Dublin, that he was likely to leave.
John, that is the tough side of it, but there's also the selfless bit that you have to give back, and everyone's chatting about Mayo's transition. Is there, you know, do you need to keep players like this involved to help the younger guys come through so that they can push on to beat the likes of the Dubs?
I would 100% agree with you there, Donica. The dressing room will be a different dynamic when these fellas go back. Like, you know, I'm going to mention Oisín Mullan, for example, who had a splendid year for Mayo. Like, he has gone in there and he has progressed brilliantly under the guidance, I suppose, watching the likes of the Keith Higgins, the Chris Barrett, the Lee Higgins. And if you go back into a dressing room now and there's four or five of these guys you would have looked up to, it's going to make it more difficult. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, like, who knows who else is going to go there? Without naming names, like Colin Boyle, there'd be a question mark over him. He made the match day squad, I think, in the Connacht final, didn't make it for the semi-final or the All-Ireland final. Shamie O'Shea, of course, in the wilderness there. Donald Vaughan has gone. Jason Doherty has had an injury ravaged season. So you could see a huge, huge different element. Now, on the flip side of that, it will let the new and up-and-coming talent, you know, flourish, and that's the big thing. But you still have huge, huge names in there. Like, please God, Lee Keegan is not going to have any decisions to make over the next couple of months. And then you've, of course, got Killian O'Connor, Aidan O'Shea is going to be still there. So you've still got a big dynamic there, but it certainly is going to be a different dressing room when training is allowed to resume.
But part of the decision as well, John, I wonder, the psychology of all of this thing, that there does come a time that even if harsh calls need to be made, that you need to clear the decks and you need to perhaps freshen things up, that you're not in a dressing room that's completely swamped with players who only have negative experiences of an All-Ireland final or whatever stigma that could be attached to big games against Dublin, big occasions, and just missing out.
Yeah, that's a tough one to call, really. But I don't think, Damien, knowing a lot of the Mayo players that have been through I suppose this pilgrimage of going and failing, you know, I don't think that's in their mindset whatsoever. And I don't think you know, this clearing at the decks thing, I think, well, from what I gather, it's the players making the decisions to go. It's not anybody else giving them a push or a shove. So, I mean, they would have played a long time. And, you know, Tom had such an injury-ravaged career. I mean, I can speak from him because he's a good friend and a clubmate of mine, and I'd know more about him than anybody else. But I suppose he would have had to deal with a lot of setbacks. He was let go from the panel in 2011 after playing compromised rules. He missed the 12 and 13 final. He got himself back in tow again. He worked so hard. In his first game back, he punctured a lung against Kildare in the league in Newbridge. You know, he played splendidly in 15, 16 and 17 for Mayo. And then, of course, he had that horrendous injury then against Galway in May 2018. And for him to come back from that is just a remarkable feat for anybody. I mean, I still cringe when I see him there in McHale Park, not far from where it happened. I still cringe looking at it. And you know, but that is the these fellas, I suppose, have given all they can. And they are probably walking away saying, we can do no more. We're surplus to requirements now when we're making our decision and leaving.
John, I read that, all about that injury this afternoon that Tom Parsons had in his knee and the reconstruction and where they had to take parts from and what exactly they put into it. I think that speaks volumes of the individual he is to say that he even got back on the panel from there.
Unbelievable, Ruby. I didn't think he was going to be able to walk actually after it. It was horrendous. And, you know, credit to Ray Moore and Indy King, the head of rehab up there that looked after Tom. And of course,
that Indy King is a bit of a genius.
And indeed, and it helps as well when you're married to a physio as Tom is, and his wife Carol gave him, you know, they worked brilliantly with him. And I actually went to the gym with him while he was rehabbing, and I was cringing watching him squatting, to be honest with you. Like, I all I could see was his knee going backwards again, and I was there, I can't watch this anymore. So I have to say, the same day he was rehabbing, I felt fit and strong, and he still burned me, but that's beside the point. But that's a testament to what he's able to do, and he's able to come back. And even this year, coming back with the lockdown and everything, Tom was absolutely flying. And on the Thursday before the league resumed and Mayo played Galway, that game against Galway when Mayo looked like they were world beaters the same day and played very, very well, Tom got injured again and he fractured a bone in his ankle that day that not many know about. So he thought, and we thought, that his season pretty much was gone again, but he done again remarkably well to recover again, to make the panel, to make the squad for the Connacht final. So he has been a remarkable, resilient player, and one we're proud of to have from Charlestown.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. We're delighted to be joined by Damien Lawler. Damien, sounds like there's quality people out there for another volume of your book. A lot of people retiring now.
Yeah, geez, I never thought of that. Before. I've only just got over the first edition, but I could from this week alone, you could do a sequel, couldn't you? It's like just a non-stop stream of people retiring, and even today, like Conor McGinn from Down went. Now, to buck the trend, actually, Audrey McNeilish has returned to the Donegal squad just this evening, so that's a huge boost for them, because on paper they are one of the very, very few teams that can actually catch Dublin. So I think there was a couple of people speculating some weeks ago that the short turnaround to the new season might prevent a lot of these elder statesmen from retiring, but it doesn't seem to be the case. I think that if your game time is very, very limited and you're putting in the effort of 31 hours a week in terms of training, leaving aside the video analysis and the meetings, if your game time is limited, you're at that stage of your career and you're not getting time on the pitch, you might not be told to walk away.
Yeah.
But you have a decision to make yourself, knowing that maybe the opportunities that were once there for you are not there anymore. And of course, every player is individual, every player is different, and they leave for varying reasons. With Tom Parsons, for example, I happen to think that his greatest achievement in GAA is coming back from that injury that Ruby and John were talking about. With David Clark, it's going to be a huge loss. It leaves Robbie Henley in pole possession of that jersey. Paddy O'Malley had just transferred up to Roscommon only 2 weeks ago. That form was signed. So it probably leaves Rory Byrne there, just let the challenge rob. So I think, yeah, in terms of experience in the dressing room, all these Mayo lads in particular, and it might not be over just yet, there'll be huge losses.
Damien, the GAA had big announcements today. There'll be no collective training for inter-county teams for the remainder of January even. What effect is that going to have on the season ahead?
I suppose, Ruby, it's going to have an effect. We probably can't look too far ahead at the moment, but I think it's safe to say anyway that it could potentially rattle the start of the Allianz League for the end of February. You would imagine that On January the 31st, the GEA will review where everything is at again. Now, this evening's numbers are slightly down from yesterday's in terms of COVID cases, and hopefully that's an indication that maybe people are starting to reduce their contacts. So if that is the case, then maybe on January the 31st you might have a more positive outlook, but it's hard to see any kind of tangible or clear progress just at the end of this month. So it could affect the start of the Allianz League, and that might knock back competitions a little bit further. But I think really the GEA had no choice, Ruby, but to make that call today. They sent out a letter to all the county secretaries just confirming that, and I think also outlining the fact that no club or county gym can stay open at this time, and rule 7.2 will be applied of the official guide. That's where a unit is adjudged to have brought the association into discredit for misconduct. Now, anecdotally speaking, counties are already back training, maybe not on GEA property, and not every county, obviously, but can that be policed? The straight answer is no, it can't, but certainly as we in terms of GEA property activity, that's out the window now. So that's maybe the major announcement from today. I think it's an announcement that has been made quite early, in fairness. January the 15th was the pencil-in date for the resumption of inter-county training, and that will now be at least 2 weeks pushed down further the track, and I'd imagine even more.
Damien, just and briefly, because we want to chat about Cork and sponsorship before we finish up, but just we're in quite a tight calendar, and the benefit that was seen of that was that we were going to bounce straight from the league straight into the championship, have everything done and dusted by the middle of July, and then off you go with the club. I know we're in uncertain times, but if the league was to be delayed, you'd imagine you're either straight away looking at a restructuring of the league or a restructuring of the general calendar for 2021.
Yeah, I think, Damien, like, I think it depends on how much of a backlog there is. Like, I think that there was a 6 week lead in from the start of the year to the start of the league, so there is a little bit of leeway there somewhere. And at the very, very end of the calendar year, Damien, there's another little bit of leeway there, because maybe you could jettison the All-Ireland Club semi-finals and put them back to the new year. So I think, in fairness to the GEA, they were met with several twists and turns last year, but they adapted fairly well. They got their championships run off, they got most of the county championships completed, and they got the under 20 football done too. So credit where credit's due, they made a right good rattle at that. This year it's going to be a lot different, I think. There will be more twists and turns. I'd be hoping that all the heavy traffic that will come against them will be the top end of the year. You would imagine, and I'm no medical expert, and by the way, one good news for the GEA is that Professor Mary Horgan, according to the Irish Independent, has been drafted onto ENFIT as well this evening. So she's on the GEA's COVID-19 advisory group. And you'd imagine now that would be a direct link in terms of insight and maybe just in terms of reflection on the activity at ground level. That would probably be a help to the GEA. But I'd be hoping, Damien, that maybe the next 6 or 7 weeks where we're dealing with this huge surge in cases will get us over the big, big hurdle, and maybe they could look ahead with some optimism with the vaccine coming into play for the remainder of the year.
Very briefly, there's a fair bit of furore brewing around Cork about the proposed, well, it's not proposed, it's a done deal with Sports Direct, Mike Ashley's sportswear firm. We can't ignore the parallel that exists between the teams that have the greatest funding and the teams which ultimately experience success. It's a difficult situation to be in, because there's not an awful lot of people willing to queue up to spend the money that's been spoken of to sponsor GAA counties.
And Damien, the money you speak of, like, the deal is said to be worth about 400,000 a year to Cork up to 2025, with further six-figure bonuses and offer for All-Ireland successes in either hurling or football. So that's a huge amount. I mean, the company Sport Direct is owned by a controversial figurehead of Newcastle United. That's Mike Ashley. So that's where maybe all the attention is coming on. I think the bottom line is every county is taking it upon itself to do what's necessary to bring revenue and bring funds in. Cork have a significant debt with Páirc Uí Chaoimh. There's no point in looking beyond that. They all want to catch the likes of Dublin in the football, and obviously now Limerick in the hurling. So you look at Roscommon, what they did, holding a raffle for a house draw in London. They made 900,000 profit. They're thinking outside the box. Every county is doing something different. Cork went down a route that a lot of people have criticised them for because of the actual nature of the company. So they did what they had to do, I guess.
Okay, we'll see how it goes. Thanks to John Casey and to Damien Lawler. Lads, we're out of time.
Very good. A massive thank you to Andrew and Laura Lee. The brilliant Tara Short's up next.
Game on 2FM.
with Green Farm. Snack smart with Green Farm's new high-protein snacking range, available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.